Isn't it nice to know that the Buddha didn't just talk about suffering? He also talked about joy. So this aspect we're going to investigate today is joy on the path, joy as a factor of awakening. And we'll just kind of do an investigation using that as a theme. So I'd like to acknowledge that we gather and sit on the traditional territory of the Saanich, Esquimalt, and Songhees, who have a historical and deep relationship to this land. And the following is on a plaque at the top of Mount Doug, which was placed there a few years ago when the indigenous name Bacalls for the area was reclaimed. Bacalls, located in Saanich territory and on the border of Lekwungen territory, this has been and remains an important meeting place for many nations. The reclamation of the name of Bacalls to replace the colonial name Mount Douglas recognizes the nation-to-nation agreements negotiated here and supports ongoing efforts of indigenous and settler people to restore balanced relationships to the lands they call home. But just a question, how many folks are here for the first time for a retreat? Okay, a few people. Yeah, welcome. And what about online folks, first time? Has everyone been kind of attended a retreat before? You can just wave your hand in the air on the computer screen. Oh, have you attended a VIMS retreat before? Okay, great. Well, welcome to all. There's a few familiar faces and some people I haven't met. So welcome to everyone. So it's been quite a time. You know, if I kind of recall, we did have an in-person retreat where Margot and I kind of shared teaching on a weekend in May. That was our first time back here in over 2 years, I believe. So it's been kind of 2.5 years where things have been disrupted for everyone. But I just want to take a moment and appreciate sitting together with like-minded folks and being able to practice each of us to practice, but also it's we're supporting each other as well. So we'll alternate kind of some sitting periods and walking periods. Generally, sits will be approximately half an hour and the walking periods will be approximately half an hour, but and there'll be some flexibility there, just to see how things go. We'll be breaking likely around noon for 1 hour for lunch. This afternoon I'll give a longer talk on the theme of joy on the path. So I'd like to just now just reflect on what's called the five precepts. And so the five precepts are really about an intention of non-harm to others and non-harm to ourselves. And they are considered a foundation for joy, even a cause for joy to arise. So these intentions of non-harm include not killing, not stealing, not lying, not harming through sexuality, and not taking intoxicants, which cloud the mind. So these gifts, these intentions are like five gifts that we can offer to the world. So this kind of ethical behavior is actually a precondition for the arising of joy, or also non-remorse. So I'd just like to read, I read a article, newspaper article about from about a month ago. It's from Ian Brown. And he talks about that this is his own experience having COVID. And it was actually his own experience having COVID for the second time, especially, which was more recently. And the article is called, "Well, I Caught COVID Again. This time, nobody cares." I guess it seemed quite different when he got COVID early in the pandemic, and the government was all collecting data and giving recommendations and contact tracing and everything. But basically, it's like maybe the instruction was, okay, isolate for 5 days and figure it out. So fortunately, he was in a house where he could go to the lower level and his partner could, provide him with food or whatever he needed. So then he just kind of reflects on his experience, which is maybe a little bit like being on a meditation retreat. And then he's reflecting kind of when he's feeling a little better, but he still has COVID, he still has some symptoms, but he still has to isolate. The main problem with having to isolate indoors with less alarming symptoms is that there is little to do but read, which inevitably leads to inhaling nonstop news, updates on the internet, which I'd submit is more debilitating than COVID. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. And it's actually, you don't really, when you get COVID, you don't have a choice. Now you have COVID. But when you go to your news source on your phone or computer or wherever it is, that's actually a choice we make. So he's kind of reflecting on, it's more debilitating than COVID to listen to the news. And he gives a list of all the bad news that we here every day. The fifth wave of COVID is nonstop. Other diseases, supply chain problems, heat waves, famine, fires, drought, assassinations, war. You can go on and on. And this is what we're kind of fed every day. And then he kind of rails against the media, who kind of benefits off bad news. Although he's part of the media too. So I think he's reflecting on that, the fact that listening to the news, being isolated, having nothing to do, isn't the best kind of thing for his state of mind. So I think he changes track. To kill time and to break my screen addiction, I return to reading books. I mean the bound, non-electrified physical gadget. The most fetching feature of the physical book is that it is not connected to the internet. And, just the only information is in between the two covers. A book does not deliver updates. It is the enemy of the updates. So then he goes on to kind of reflect on I guess he started to look at Canadian politics and he wasn't happy with that. But then he says, he started looking at the images that were broadcast back to Earth from the James Webb telescope and got quite fascinated with those. So he said, it's surprising how philosophical you can get calmly awaiting the ebbing of the virus on repeat. By the time my isolation ended, I was spending an hour a day gazing at the astonishing images being transmitted 1.5 million kilometers back to Earth from the James Webb telescope. So it seems like he's getting a little calmer now. Then he kind of concludes, I'm grateful to be over COVID again. I don't want it to come back for fear the next time is worse. but I will miss the chance to sit in the cool understory of her basement, forced to do nothing but wonder, struck dumb with awe at the unlikely miracle of being here. You know, maybe just inspired by these images from the space telescope. But I was just kind of noting about choices that in the article that he made that were kind of beneficial to his state of mind. And that has a lot to do with Buddhist teachings. It's the choices that we make. This is a verse from the Dhammapada. And basically it says, it's talking about our mind. It's in the chapter called The Mind. So I just thought this was an interesting perspective. And I'll just paraphrase first, is that he's saying that our mind can be our friend and actually our best friend, but our mind can also be our enemy. It can be our worst enemy. So whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. Neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. So one of the questions, like what I like to do on a day-long retreat is kind of just maybe suggest a question or two that we could all kind of individually reflect on. Just bring to mind every so often, just ask the question, don't worry about answering it, and just see if anything pops up. But it's how can we make our mind our friend? Like what conditions help that to be the case? And how can we avoid our mind being our enemy? And we might just reflect on our own path through life. And maybe at times our mind was more of our friend, and sometimes our mind was more not our friend. And just kind of ask that question, like how can we help, and what conditions are conducive to our mind being our friend? So not too long ago, I recently was chatting with my elderly aunt, and so she's going to be 95 this year. And one of the things that I really appreciate about my aunt is, in spite of she's got quite a few physical challenges, you know, serious physical challenges, and but yet she seems to keep still a positive frame of mind, where it could easily be one of kind of increased suffering and complaining from her state, physical state. But her mind is still in a very good state. And one thing she said was, because she goes to doctor's appointments, you know, regularly, and she says, you know, I don't expect them to cure me. If they can make me a little better, that's sort of great. So I thought that was an interesting take, as opposed to kind of having this, I think, unrealistic expectation that every ailment at age 95 is going to be cured. So I don't expect them to cure me. And what I also take from her is, in talking with her, how she views life is she kind of says, you know, there's things that are outside of your control, and there's things within your control. So take those things and put them out of your mind that are not within your control, and focus on the things that are within your control. So I think that helps her considerably in her kind of approach to life. So And she does cultivate qualities like gratitude as well. But I'll tell one more story, that because I we're having a visit, we're having some little coffee visit, and I reminded her a couple of years ago, she was getting more and more concerned. She's a social activist from before it was like popular to be social activists, like way back. And but lately she's becoming more concerned about the environment and especially climate change. So she's, I think, you know, she's trying to think, well, you know, what can I do? And one thing she could do, she thought she would write some letters. So she took a lot of care to draft up, just, you know, went over and over a very good letter. And she kind of identified all the politicians she could think of to send this letter to, you know, using, you know, real paper, real envelope. So she sent it to, you know, prime minister, all the federal leaders, cabinet ministers, every provincial leader, everyone she could think of, she sent a letter to. So I was just kind of, reminded her of this, because I thought, wow, that's amazing. In her 90s, she's like going with this effort and doing something that she's, rather than sitting back and worrying, some activity. And then I didn't know this, because this latest piece, but she at a certain point she laughed, and I didn't know that. She said, you know who sent me a letter back? The only one who sent me a letter back? Erin O'Toole. The last person she would have voted for. But she laughed. But I think it's less, you know, it, I mean, even her actions of sending these letters had an effect, a positive effect on me, hearing this this story of her efforts. So I think it's less what the end result is and more the intention that she brought to this endeavor. So anyway, so I'll just read one more quote, and then we'll sit for a little bit. And this quote is from a book that I really like. It's called The Book of Joy. That's that. It relates a gathering between the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, and Douglas Abrams helped to write it. So these are actually the Dalai Lama's words from his introduction. No dark fate determines the future. We do. Each day and each moment, we are able to create and recreate our lives and the very quality of human life on our planet. This is the power we yield. So this is from the Book of Joy. And the subtitle is interesting: Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. So making wise choices, making our mind into our friend, and sort of how can we have this kind of happiness that is not dependent on outside conditions. So what we'll do is we'll sit maybe for 25 minutes. So just get comfortable. We'll just kind of see if we can settle in after all our activity of getting here. And maybe just take a few conscious breaths to start with. And just to to have us encourage us to just settle into the present moment. And we can also settle into our bodies, to our experience of the body, sitting here, you know, being in this room. Being in this group, including the people on online, just reflecting, we're with some people who share these values. And just to help us, bring us back to the present moment, I'll just kind of do a little survey of the body, just mentioning different parts. And we could just bring our attention, if you like, to these areas of the body. We'll just move down from the top. So from the crown, just bring the attention to the crown of the head. Just notice any sensations in that area. If we notice any tension, as best you can, just relax. Bring the attention down to the eyes. Notice any sensations in the area. And just see if we can relax any of the muscles around the eyes. Now extend the awareness to the entire face, the ears. This is helping to just bring us back to this present moment. Notice any sensations, could be temperature, heat, cold, or any vibrations we might feel, sensations of air moving across the face, or internal sensations as well. Let's relax the tongue. Moving down, paying attention to the neck area. Then the shoulders. Relaxing any built-up tension in the shoulders. Notice if there's a difference from one side to the other. If there's a little more tension on one side, we can relax that side. Keep the attention coming down the arms, the upper arms, elbows, forearms. Noticing any sensations. Now the hands, all the different nerves and components of the hands. Bring the attention back to the upper back, the spine, shoulder blades. And moving down, include the middle section. In the lower back. Now bring the attention to the front of the torso, the upper part of the torso. Include the rib cage. We might feel sensations of breathing. Moving down, kind of the middle area of the torso. And then the belly area. Relaxing any tension that we might notice as best we can. Now include the pelvis area, the pelvic area. the buttocks. Now include the thighs. The knees. The calves. The ankles. And the feet. The upper part of the feet. The soles. The toes. You can feel our feet connected to the earth, touching the earth. There's a quote from Ajahn Mun on the body. In your investigation of the world, never allow the mind to desert the body. Examine its nature. See the elements that comprise it. See the impermanence, the suffering, the selflessness of the body. While sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. When its true nature is seen fully and lucidly by the heart, the wonders of the world will become clearer. In this way, the purity of the mind can shine forth, timeless and delivered. So we'll just sit for a few more minutes. You can keep your awareness in the body or with the breath. If the mind drifts off, we just gently bring it back to our object of meditation. We'll have a half hour walking period, and you can go outside, or there's a deck out from the upstairs. The traditional walking for meditation is find kind of a path that's 10 or 15 paces long, and just kind of slowly go back and forth. So we're not walking to get somewhere, but we're maintaining our mindfulness and having this mindfulness while we're in motion. So often you pay particular attention to the lower part of the body, the feet, the legs that are in motion. And sometimes what I do is if I get to the end of the path, I might just take a moment, take a breath, renew kind of that intention of being present before taking going on the next. What we're going to do just to start this next meditation period, we'll probably sit for about 30 minutes, is listen to a chant if the technology gods are with us. Suzanne is going to play the chant, and we'll see if we can use a external speaker here to listen to it. So the chant is called Dasa Parami. Dasa means 10. Parami means perfections. So these are qualities, 10 qualities that the Buddha taught and suggested that we cultivate for our well-being and the well-being of the world. So I'm going to try and remember the 10. Maybe Margot can help me if I forget a few. I don't know. Ethical conduct, generosity, renunciation. I think it's kind of intelligence or wisdom, energy, truth, determination. We're getting there. So metta or loving kindness, goodwill, and equanimity. So I think I'm short one, but oh, energy, virya. Oh, there we have patience. Good one. Yeah. The key to it all, patience. So, but the chant is in Pali. It's really beautiful. And just wanted to, there's 10 kind of short stanzas that's what it's referring to, is the cultivation of these 10 qualities. So let's see if we can hear it.
The 10 perfections. Dana parami, dana upaparami, dana paramata parami, maitri metta karuna, mudita upeka, kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava. Sila parami, sila upaparami, sila paramata parami, maitri metta karuna, mudita upeka, kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava. Nekamma parami, nekamma upaparami, nekamma paramata parami, maitri metta karuna, mudita upeka, kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava. Panya parami, panya upaparami, panya paramata parami, maitri metta karuna, mudita upeka, Kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava viriya parami viriya upaparami viriya paramata parami maitri metta karuna mudita upeka Kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava kanti parami kanti upaparami kanti paramata parami maitri metta karuna mudita upeka kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava Satcha parami, satcha upaparami, satcha paramata parami, maitri metta karuna mudita upeka, kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava. Adittana parami, adittana upaparami, adittana paramata parami, maitri metta karuna mudita upeka, kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava. Metta parami, metta upaparami, metta paramata parami, maitri metta karuna mudita upeka kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava upeka parami, upeka paparami, upeka paramata parami, maitri metta karuna mudita upeka kusala sampanno iti piso bhagava iti piso bhagava arahang sammasambuddho vijjacharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati sata deva manusanang buddho bhagavati.
So let's just let those kind of those reverberations from this chant, these beautiful sounds, you can feel those in the body, in the mind. Just bring the attention to either the body or the breath. Notice where it's easiest to feel the breathing in the body and place a light attention at that spot. That can be our meditation object. And if our attention gets distracted, thoughts come up, whenever we notice that has happened, we just very gently bring the attention back to our meditation object. This may happen frequently, and that's fine. Just whenever we notice and bring the attention back. So this awareness can notice when we get distracted. As our meditation comes to a close, just thinking thoughts of goodwill. These could be for people who are close to us, people we know well, people we know but not that well, even thoughts of goodwill to those we have trouble with. And alternatively, we could just kind of spread that energy, those thoughts of goodwill in all directions. And we include ourselves. We are part of that world. All right, you can open your eyes now. We'll have another walking period for half an hour. One thing you could add to your walking period is actually thoughts of goodwill. So if you pass by someone, you could just silently say to yourself, may you be well. If you're outside and you notice an animal, a deer or a squirrel, just say, may you be well, kind of internally, just having those thoughts. And can keep that energy going as we just mindfully use movement. So we're going a little more multimedia now, and we're going to watch about a 7-minute YouTube video. It's so James Berez is a senior meditation teacher, and he made this video with his mother. And his mother, I forget his mother's name, Selma. Yeah. So I think she's deceased now. This was a few years ago. So her comedic timing is impeccable. So let's now, unfortunately, we just have a tiny screen, so it's going to be hard, for people to see, but mainly you'll hear, or if you want to move a little closer to the computer, it's readily available. Also, if you just do a little search, James Berez's mother on YouTube. And we'll just try and coordinate with the Zoom people. We're going to sort of view it independently, but at the same time.
Good evening. I'm so happy to be here and meet you. My son did not quite tell the truth. Today, I am 91 and a half. Excellent. My son also did not tell another thing about our relationship. My son, and I hate to divulge this, has ruined my life. As a Jewish mother, I never thought that I would have to tell the secret. Jewish mothers are born with certain genes They can't be acquired. They can only be very carefully honed. Jewish mothers are born to complain. Actually, it's called kvetching. We will always find something to complain about. It also helps with a long sigh. A few tears also help, but complain we must. It's either too sunny out or too dull out, or it's raining or we don't have enough rain. We always find something. And mostly, we send out this perfect child to the world expecting he or she to become a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer is also acceptable, but a Jew boo? We also have another quality. We worry about everything. If one of my children is late to meet me, I can write scenarios about what has happened to them that Hollywood would give millions to him. I can write about disasters that probably will occur in this universe, I don't know. But anyhow, it's just been so wonderful to keep complaining and to be worried and to be unhappy. Despite the fact that I have led the most incredible life that anybody can wish for. I've been everywhere in this world except Iceland. I was married to the love of my life. And except for the fact that I raised two rotten children, I really have nothing to complain about. Last year, James, as he told you, came to stay with me while my wonderful daughter was out of the country. Daughters are really special. And I guess James got so tired of hearing me complain about everything and nothing that we started this little mantra. And every time I complained about something, which is every third second, he said, "Mom, why don't you follow this? But I know I am truly blessed." And we started this game. By golly, it really works. I do that with every complaint, but it really helps. And I really have become, oh, this kills me, a happy... I really have become a happier person. I just now have divulged a secret. He has ruined my entire life. Hey, rotten kid.
Well, it's just this one. Yep. It's kind of hard to follow that act. Wisdom from Selma Berres. Yeah, so just take a moment, and that there's kind of wisdom and humor in that sharing that we just listened to. And it also takes some intention to cultivate this joy or happiness. So maybe I'll just kind of finish my little part with a story from the suttas, where I heard this from Ajahn Sona. Excuse me. A monk at the time of the Buddha. This monk had this kind of habit of whenever he was able, he would go off into the forest and meditate. And during his meditation, he would just repeat this word over and over, and it was sukha, 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 sukha. He would just say this over and over like a mantra. And what the word sukha means, so you might have heard the word dukkha, which is suffering, often translated as suffering. So sukha means happiness. So this monk is off in the forest just saying sukha, sukha. Now the other monks might pass by and hear this, and they're kind of curious, like, why is this monk repeating this? And they start to talk amongst themselves, and they happen to know that this monk used to be a king. And so with all the things that go along with being a king, they start to kind of speculate. Maybe he's remembering the time when he was a king, and all the beautiful things he had access to, and he's kind of reminiscing and wishing kind of that he had that again, just saying sukha, sukha, thinking of what he had in the past as a king. So they come and talk to the Buddha and kind of raise this as a concern, like maybe this is un-monk-like behavior. So the Buddha says, well, ask him to come and I'll talk to him. And so they do. They go and ask this monk to go talk to the Buddha, and they kind of all gather around. And the Buddha says, well, I've heard this from a few of the monks that you go off into the forest and you kind of repeat sukha, sukha, sukha. Why is that? And this monk says, well, you know, I used to be a king. And it was very difficult being a king. Like, so many people wanted to kill me. I had to have many food tasters because to make sure the food wasn't poisoned. The countries on the borders wanted to attack and take over. I had to monitor these armies. I had many wives, but it wasn't going so well. They were kind of arguing amongst themselves and seemed to be getting angry at me. So my life as a monk, all I have is my robe, my bowl for food, and I just feel so wonderful that I don't feel burdened by all those trappings of being a king in the past. So that's why I repeat, sukha, sukha, sukha. It feels so good. No one is going to kill me. I have nothing that anyone is going to steal from me. So I feel very happy in this life. So anyway, that's the story of sukha, sukha of this monk. And maybe we can just reflect, is there something that we can let go of that is creating some burdensome aspect to our own lives? And so let's settle in again for a meditation sit. This is usually the sleepy sit after lunch. So what I'll do is give a guided meditation, and it's up to you if you want to follow the instructions. But it's kind of just paying attention to different parts of the body and experimenting with breathing for our well-being. So we can take a few deeper breaths, just now just bring the attention to the belly area. And what we'll do is use our imagination. We'll imagine that we're breathing breath energy into that area. But first we'll just kind of check what that area feels like, locate that area in our imagination. Relax any tension we might notice. Now imagine we're breathing into the belly area, breathing this breath energy. And we can experiment to see what kind of breathing is most comfortable. So you can try long breathing or short, deeper, shallow, in, short out long, or in long out short, just to, with the aim of bringing ease to the body. Breathing into the belly area. See if we can cultivate some ease in that area, some comfortable feelings, sensations. Now we can move our attention up to the solar plexus area. Just locate that area in our mind. Notice any tension, or see if we can cultivate a relaxation in that area. Now imagine breathing into this solar plexus area. All this breath energy of the body. Now move the attention up to the heart area. And imagine we're breathing into the heart area, our breath energy, breathing in a way that's comfortable. Dissolving any tension. I'm moving the attention up to the throat area. Imagine this breath energy in the throat area. Breathing in a way that's comfortable. So moving the attention to the middle of the head. Imagine the breath energy going to this area of the body. breathe in a way that's comfortable. Now, using the imagination again, imagine we're breathing in to the back of the neck and the breath energy is coming down our arms to our hands. As we breathe out, it's just dissipating from all those areas. So imagine breathing in through this breath energy coming in the back of the neck, down the shoulders, down the arms, to the hands. And as we breathe out, just dissipates out. Again, breathing in a way that's comfortable. Now again, imagine we're breathing in the back of the neck. This time, the breath energy is coming down either side of the spine to the lower back or coccyx area. So imagine we're breathing in the back of the neck. This energy is coming down the spine to the coccyx area. And as we breathe out, it just dissipates out from all those areas. Breathe in a way that's comfortable. This time, we'll imagine we're breathing in to the lower back area or the coccyx, and this breath energy is coming down the legs, down to the feet. And as we breathe out, it dissipates from all those areas. Breathe in a way that's comfortable. So again, we're breathing in the lower back or coccyx area with our imagination, Imagine this breath energy coming down the legs to the feet, then dissipating out. Now, for the last, say, 10 minutes of our meditation, just choose any of those areas where we might focus our breath, or choose an area where it's easy to notice the breath, keep the mind in that area. And if possible, if you feel any pleasant sensations in a part of the body, just see if they can expand into other parts. So just seeing if we can cultivate kind of a pleasant sensations in the body. As we come to the end of our meditations, thinking thoughts of goodwill, either for individual people or just spreading thoughts of goodwill, goodwill energy in all directions, above, below, and all around. And include yourself with these wishes. Wishes for health, for happiness, for ease in life, for well-being. With no distinction. Just with that, we can open our eyes. We can have another walking period until 2 o'clock. So could someone ring the bell at 5:02? So what I would like to do is, with this talk, is first talk about some kind of obstacles to joy that we might experience and just investigate those a bit, and then talk about qualities that can support joy. So in the life of the Buddha, in the Buddha's life, there's an interesting interaction that took place. So shortly after the Buddha's awakening, which took place in Bodh Gaya, in what would be present day India, and this is 2600 years ago. So shortly after, the Buddha, it is said, the Buddha was kind of reflecting on his experience, this profound experience, this enlightenment experience he had sitting under the Bodhi tree. And one might imagine he's in a pretty blissful state at this time. And then a thought came to him. Kind of a question came to him. And the question was, well, would it be possible to teach others about what I've experienced so they could experience this profound state of liberation and kind of this happiness that I've discovered and experienced? So, the first thought that comes to him after having this question come to him was, you know, I don't think anybody would get it. I just don't think they'd get it. It's sort of like it's too subtle and profound at the same time. Yeah, I don't think they'd get it. And then he uses a metaphor, which I find really interesting. So the metaphor is he says or thinks, people have too much dust in their eyes to be able to understand what I might teach. So now the story gets a little stranger, because now a deva appears in front of Buddha. And this deva is from kind of the highest heaven realms of the Brahma realms. Deva's name is Sahampati. And I think Sahampati is been following the Buddha's awakening and is very happy about this. And is quite distraught that the Buddha may decide not to teach. Like, so somebody appears in front of the Buddha and says, Buddha, there are those with little dust in their eyes who would understand. So the Buddha reconsiders and, using, I presume, some kind of psychic abilities, kind of surveys the world and actually discovers Sahampati is correct, that there are some who have little dust in their eyes and would understand. Now, he didn't say everybody would understand, but he said there are those with little dust in their eyes. So again, they're using this this metaphor. So, of course, I'm kind of curious. Well, what did the Buddha really mean by dust in the eyes? Any thoughts? Maybe I'll throw it out and you can type in if you have a thought. Like, what do you think the Buddha meant by at first thinking, oh, too much dust in the eyes, they won't get it. Okay, little dust in the eyes, they might understand. Any thoughts? Their actions actually produce kind of getting entangled in a cycle of suffering, even though think, oh, that's going to make me happy, and but it doesn't produce a long-term happiness, which is what the Buddha found. So along these same lines, so I'm gonna, this is kind of consistent with some of what was suggested, is I'm gonna suggest that what the Buddha was referring to, and this is sort of my kind of putting these together, seems to make sense to me, is another list that the Buddha had, and it's the list of five hindrances. So the five hindrances are greed, aversion, sometimes called sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. These five qualities, and even the word hindrance is kind of telling. So so Sharon Salzberg says, one time she referred to these five as greedy, grumpy, sleepy, anxious, and or dubious. That's her phrases for the five hindrances. Now, of course, the Buddha gave different teachings about the antidote to different of the hindrances. So, and there's, I'm sure, lots of talks on Dharma Seed and other places about, you know, specifically about the five hindrances. One main thing is, it seems to me, if a hindrance arises and one has some awareness of that hindrance, that's really useful, as opposed to just being caught in. And probably the easiest hindrance to feel is anger. And if you're caught in anger and act out of anger, one doesn't have any choice anymore. And I think is seeing seeing the world in a distorted way. So anger would probably be the easiest one to feel, but I think we could extrapolate to the other hindrances as well. Is it kind of takes away our ability to choose wisely. So one other thing just to add to this is something I heard Ajahn Sona say is kind of struck me. The hindrances are a misinformation factory. They are a factory of misinformation. I mean, there's so much information, misinformation out there, but we have our own little generator as well. So that's the one that we can pay attention to and maybe have an effect on. The similes that the Buddha uses for the different hindrances are, he has a set of similes that have to do with water, and there's different ways that that the water, for example, can get cloudy and you can't see clearly through it, or there's waves, or it's affected by wind and it's choppy and you can't see through it, or it's boiling and you can't see it affects. So that kind of fits with the dust in the eyes, like affecting one's vision of what's true, what's not true. I'll just read something. This is from a talk that Ajahn Sona gave. I think the key to removing hindrances is to recognize a hindrance when it has arisen. Remember that hindrances are factories of misinformation. They take us away from knowing the true cause of suffering. But we can recognize the hindrance with our awareness. There is the hindrance arising, and there is our knowing of it. So this allows us to not get caught up in the hindrance, to not take the bait, to not go down the road of unskillful thought and action. How does anger feel? You know, to give an example, it doesn't feel good. It actually feels terrible. And that can give us ample motivation to remove it. But first we have to have awareness. Oh, it's anger has arisen. One other, kind of common instruction is to just see if we can replace that hindrance with its opposite. So to take anger as the example, you cultivate goodwill. Greed, cultivate generosity, and for agitation, for restlessness, cultivate serenity practices. For sloth and torpor, or sleepiness, here's the list. Visualize light, visualize water, meditate on faith, or meditate on death. That can provide motivation then to practice with more energy. And then doubt. Also serenity practices, but there's a curious one. Asking questions of wise people. So try and find someone who you admire and kind of maybe hang out with that person, learn from that person. Admirable friendship. And I'll just a little more on this. There's a... there's some more similes that the Buddha uses about the when hindrances are removed. So there's five of these. And you can see very consistently the Buddha's, in the Buddhist teachings, it's indicates that as a hindrance either temporarily is removed or permanently removed, joy arises. But these are interesting kind of similes, five similes for the five hindrances. Suppose that a person is in debt and then is able to repay the loan. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. Another one. Suppose that a person falls sick, in pain, and seriously ill. They eventually recover from that illness. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. Suppose a person is bound in prison. They are eventually released from that bondage. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. Suppose that a person is a slave, subject to others, not subject to themselves, unable to go where they like, and is eventually freed from that slavery. They experience freedom. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. Now, suppose that a person carrying valuables has to travel by a road through a desolate and dangerous country. As time passes, they eventually emerge from that dangerous country safe and sound, with no loss of their valuable property. Because of that, they would experience gladness and happiness. So here we have these five hindrances, and as they kind of dissipate, then gladness and happiness is the result. And a quote from Christina Feldman, who's coming next month, actually. There is joy in seeing the calming and the falling away of aversion, fear, and doubt. There is joy in discovering we are just a little less judgmental, impatient, or agitated. These are the falling away of the hindrances. Maybe I'll just talk about other obstacles to joy, which probably fit under the five hindrance kind of umbrella, but something I call what's next-ism. And so I'm going to tell a story. Margot might be familiar with this story, but back in the end of the 1990s, June and myself and our daughter, who was two turning three, we moved to central Massachusetts, where there's a large insight meditation society organization. And June got a job as the personnel director there. And Margo was there at that time too. And so one day, and I took our daughter Kiko to a meal at the center, and we went into the kind of lunchroom area. And there's sometimes teachers around and staff, and we have our meal. And I'm guessing it's the evening, but anyway, Steve Armstrong, senior teacher, is hanging around, and we finished our meal. And for some reason, we're just kind of standing there, maybe chatting a little bit. And Steve is there. And our daughter's super restless. Maybe she's four at the time. She's just bouncing around. And she's just saying, what's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? And Steve kind of hears her and kind of looks at her and says, what's now? And that causes our daughter, you know, probably to stop for 5 seconds or so. Like, it makes her think a little bit, you know, before she gets bouncy again. So I think it's a good example of, I think this is a very common kind of mental state that we get in. What's next? What's next? What's next? And joy is going to arise right now. So that can be an impediment to joy as well. Did I get the story right? Have you heard that story? Oh, okay. So that's a little bit about some obstacles to joy. So I'd like to not leave it there, because it might get too depressing. So what supports joy? So I heard this story of, it's a true story. This young woman was aspiring to be a journalist and maybe write stories, sell them to magazines or publish them on the internet. So it was just looking for opportunities. And she happens to be at a community center and she sees a notice on the bulletin board that says chess lessons from and I believe it was a 6-year-old boy. Like the indicator was this young boy giving chess lessons. And she thought, this might be a good story to write about. So that's her motivation. She signs up the chess lessons. She might learn something about the boy, but also just kind of this experience of this very young boy offering chess lessons. So she arrives at her lesson, and I guess they're talking and maybe setting up the board and talking about chess a little bit. And at a certain point, she asks this young boy, because she's kind of strikes her, like, doesn't it, like, and she learns that he goes to competitions, and there'll be obviously older, more experienced players, chess folks at these competitions. So she says, like, doesn't it really bother you when you go in a competition and you lose a match, like, which I'm sure that happens frequently. And his response is, oh no, that is great. I get to make a mistake and then learn what to do better the next time. So he didn't really, like, it didn't bother him at all. It, in fact, he was kind of excited to be able to learn a lesson in this way. And I'm sure he found whoever he was playing would be very generous in, you know, giving some instructions about, well, next time you could try this or try that. So it became an opportunity for him. And that's how he saw it. And this is a young boy to learn. So seemed like a very good kind of way to approach learning, like having this kind of attitude of open to learning. And so this young woman was remembering her kind of experience of playing chess with her, I think, former boyfriend, where they'd play, generally he would win, she would get really upset, and invariably the chess pieces would end up on the floor. And it kind of struck her how this boy viewed that kind of whole situation so differently. So so I guess the point I'm trying to make is that what supports joy is an ability to learn from our mistakes as we go through life. And probably this boy didn't even view like that this was like a mistake, or he didn't really view this as a competition. It was opportunities to learn as he went along. So I think that is an important point in kind of supporting joy, is the ability to learn. I mean, we don't have to make every mistake in the book. I mean, we can learn from other people's mistakes too. That's okay. That's allowed. Then, so the next quality that I think supports joy is humor. And, you know, maybe we had a little example of it from that short video this morning of Selma Baraz talking about her lesson of adding this phrase of complain and I'm truly blessed. So this particular book, The Book of Joy, and this is a meeting between Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. It's a wonderful book. They're getting together. And it's full of humor. They are always, they clearly have a great deal of respect for each other, even though they come from different religious backgrounds. And they often are teasing each other. I think at one point, there's something about Desmond Tutu talking about, you know, destinations after death and, you know, going to heaven or the other place. And Dalai Lama is suggesting, well, he probably is going to the other place. And, you know, so the Dalai Lama speaking to some journalists about the reunion with his friend Desmond Tutu. So then I told them that you, he's referring to Desmond Tutu, describe me as a mischievous person. And so I said, I also consider you a mischievous person. The meeting of two mischievous people is wonderful. Very happy reunion. And then they both laugh. A few minutes later, Desmond Tutu, kind of maybe in reply, says after some more teasing of the Dalai Lama, I think that was where he's talking about Dalai Lama's chances of getting into heaven. I think one of the best things that ever happened to me was meeting you. So this kind of combination of teasing and love between the two of them. So I think humor can be a great support of joy. And also, I think it helps us not take ourselves quite so seriously. So another quality that supports joy is ethical conduct. It's called sila in Pali, or virtue. And talked a little bit about this when we were kind of reflecting on the five precepts. So sila, or virtue, or ethical conduct, is really about non-harm. And to seen in another way, it's an expression of metta, of goodwill. And this ethical conduct protects our own mind, and our sila protects others. It helps us to have a settled mind both in our lives and in our meditation. So I remember being at Birken one time with a few people, and I think we stayed for a week. And then it's often kind of done that one asks when one is leaving the monastery to take the five precepts with the abbot. So that's what we did. And you make a little offering, and then you do some chanting, take the five precepts, which is the five precepts about non-harm, about not killing, stealing, etc. And I remember Ajahn Sona kind of saying, kind of like, okay, you can go out. And in my mind, I was taking the precepts to protect others. But he said, it's kind of like, okay, you may go now. You are protected. So it protects yourself, you know, as well as others. And ethical conduct is often viewed as being kind of a precondition to joy arising. One other quality would be generosity. So there's a monk who's visited Victoria a few times, Ajahn Tiridamal. You might have attended a day long or met him when he was here. So, I'm actually hoping he might come our way next summer. It would be nice. He's living in Australia right now. So there's a story that Ajahn Tiridhamo told. He's a senior monk, and he was an abbot in a monastery, a Thai forest monastery in Switzerland. I mean, when I first heard that, I think, Ajahn, you were a Thai forest monastery in Switzerland? Like, how does that happen? Well, I think there's a bunch of Thai people in Switzerland and they support this monastery. So he was the abbot. And there'd be Thai people and Western people come to the monastery. So he tells the story of kind of being out. And then he comes into the monastery, and there's kind of two activities happening, and more a group of Westerners, more Europeans, are practicing meditation in the meditation sala, and they look pretty grim. I mean, they've kind of like got nibbana or bust, you know, on their forehead, and it's probably bust is how it's going to go. Just with they're looking a bit grim, as I said. So the other scene that he observes is in the kitchen, and a group of Thai women are making the meal for the day. And they are having the greatest time making this meal. You know, they're so joyful. And he just sort of, it was just something he contrasted. It struck him as being, oh, they're being generous there, and its happiness is the result. Now, maybe you can have a bit of both. Maybe you can mix those two and get a balance. So the next quality talk a little bit about is gratitude or appreciation. So I think this can be really, really important, and a really, like in terms of making our, like to use the, something I mentioned in, from the Dhammapada this morning, like to making our mind into our friend. As opposed to viewing the world and seeing what's lacking, to have gratitude for all the kind of help we've gotten along the way. It's a different perspective that we can have. And that was, I think, in that video we watched, that was part of the message of that. Again, from this Book of Joy, quote, "I've never seen Archbishop Tutu miss an opportunity to thank someone or appreciate what he has been given. He will stop an entire production or an event to acknowledge all that are present." So that's that is, I think, an attitude that we can consciously kind of develop. So the next area is that it supports joy would be metta or goodwill. And it's actually part of a group of four qualities that are associated with metta. These are called the Brahma Viharas. Brahma Vihara kind of means like a very good place to live. And so kind of like a heavenly realm. So the first is metta. And I think I'll just read something from Bhante Gunaratana. Because metta, sometimes it can feel pretty abstract, kind of like something so elevated, but it can also be very practical, like that we can practice every day in simple ways. And so Bhante Gunaratna gives an example. There's a couple of things he says. He gives one example. So one day he's riding in a taxi in Singapore, and the driver sees him in his monk's robes and says, "Sir, if I had lots of money, I could do a lot of good work." So Bhante Gunaratna, who's a monk in the Sri Lankan tradition, "You don't need too much money to do good things," I said. "As you're driving your taxi, suppose you see a woman trying to catch a taxi. Well, you stop for her, open the door for her, help her into the taxi. If you're a smoker, don't smoke. Speak gently and kindly. Drive her to her destination directly without taking her all around the city to charge her more. When you reach the destination, come around and open the door for her. Holding her hand, walk her to the sidewalk and let her go with a sense of gratitude towards you." Bhante Gunaratna adds, "When you do this, you will be very glad. Whenever you think of what you have done, in addition to driving the taxi, you will feel happy. You see, you can do all this without even an additional penny. You don't need money to have a good heart and practice metta." Then he goes on another practical example. "When I travel, sometimes I go to public bathrooms. If the bathroom is not clean, I clean it. On airplanes, I clean the bathroom after I use it. I wish the next person coming to the bathroom will be pleased to see a clean toilet. Nobody knows who cleaned the toilet. I feel very glad to have done it." So you don't necessarily think about cleaning toilets as metta, but seems to make sense. Small things like this are in truth not small at all. They are ways to practice loving friendliness every day. So that would be, you know, one kind of practical example of metta. Sometimes we practice metta in our meditation, as we've done a little bit. As far as the Brahma Viharas, there's four qualities. So metta is the first. The next two are when kind of goodwill, the first one is meets someone who's suffering. So this would be compassion. And compassion, as the Buddha would teach, would be universal. So it's not just for people who are close to us. And it's, so Ajahn Sona, he calls compassion the sacred recipe. And sometimes it's called the trembling of the heart. So this has to do with kind of as we are connected to others. And the next Brahma Vihara, so the third Brahma Vihara is, well, so compassion is karuna, so we have metta, karuna. Mudita is the next of the Brahma Viharas, and it doesn't really have a great translation into English, which might say something about our culture. But sometimes it's called sympathetic joy. So it is loving kindness when you come into contact with someone who has good fortune. In Thailand, or if you're around Thai people, they might give a greeting of anumodana. And that is said in the context of they've learned that you've done some kind of generous or wholesome action, beneficial action, generous action. And the this greeting, Anumodana, kind of a response to that, would be something like, I rejoice in your kind of good actions. So it's a beautiful kind of a phrase or a beautiful meaning. And, you know, it also counteracts feelings of envy, for example. Oh, that person got something. Yeah, I kind of wanted that. They have it. I don't. Wish I had that. Wish they didn't. Or so the Dalai Lama's take on mudita is, if your goal is to be happy, and you practice mudita, you have very good odds of being happy. There's like 8 billion people in the world. There's going to be a lot of people who are happy. And if you're happy for them, your odds are really good to be happy. Ajahn Sona, normally you would like to be the winner, but you can be the winner every time. There's a, from the Sri Lankan tradition, there's a kind of a, this is from a Sri Lankan text. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight you that you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue. Kind of expressions of mudita. Then the final of the Brahma Viharas is called equanimity. So this is a little different than the first three. The first three are more wishes. I wish for your good fortune. I wish your suffering gets better, or I take joy. I wish your joy to continue. But this is more of a statement of, well, this is how the world is. And it takes into account like karma. So one of the phrases around equanimity is to do with karma, and it's about actions and the results of actions. So would say, I am the owner of my actions. Like I inherit the results of my actions, but also you are the owner of your actions. You inherit the results of your actions. So it kind of differentiates like what we can control, what's out of our control. We can, I think it is very skillful to have good wishes for others, but we can't necessarily solve all these problems of others, but we can kind of work within our arena, work with, so there's some things that are outside of our control and some things that are within our control. So cultivating good qualities we can do. And that can be a relief when you say, wow, there's where you kind of identify what you can do and what's outside of your control. One other quality just that comes to mind is kind of how one responds to the difficulties one inevitably will face in life. And so the story that kind of I come back to as far as seeing someone who I admire would be Nelson Mandela, who spent 27 years in prison. I was watching a documentary on Cape Town in South Africa, and they included scenes of the Robben Island, which is the prison island off the coast, where Nelson Mandela was held for 27 years. And the person who was being interviewed actually took the TV crew, the person around Nelson, or around the prison, and they could see this person actually had been a former prisoner as well at Robben Island and knew Nelson Mandela, was there when Nelson Mandela was there. So this person was being interviewed and just talking about the prison and his memories of, so they could, you could see the cell that that Nelson Mandela lived in all those years, and the different areas, the quarry where he broke rocks. And so he was asked, this former prisoner from Robben Island was asked, like, what comes to mind when you think of Nelson Mandela in Robben Island in prison? And he said two words. He said, dignity and integrity. So I just, that really struck me as being pretty amazing that one could cultivate those qualities in those conditions. So it's, I think, for me, kind of inspiring that this is possible in the, that humans are can do that. So I think sometimes it's a good practice just to think of someone who's really inspiring. Like, it might be somebody in your family or somebody you know, or somebody you don't know personally, but just to consider, oh, this is possible within this human realm. So there's a teaching, there's a sutta where the Buddha is kind of listing, it's called the Six Recollections. And these are recollections which cause joy to arise. So this is in what's called the Pali Canon, the recordings of the Buddhist teachings. So these six are, and they're called the Six Recollections. Recollecting the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, recollecting one's virtues, recollecting one's generosity, and recollecting the Devas are causes for joy to arise. So the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, these are called the Triple Gem. And for me, well, the Dhamma are the teachings of the Buddha, and they also can be, like, I see them as being truths, and the Buddha described them as the Four Noble Truths. So recollecting the Buddha, the Buddha who spent 45 years, like, after his enlightenment, taught for 45 years. And just having confidence in, oh, this is a possibility, this enlightenment. The Buddha was a human being and became awake or enlightened. Then the Dhamma, about the teachings of the Buddha. And then the Sangha are those often referred to the monastics who he taught, that so kind of represents the spreading of the Dhamma, but also that others can learn from these teachings and become kind of liberated themselves. So to me, when I think of those, it's like I tend to think that it is possible then to make wise choices. So I'm not committed to just automatic reactions. I can make wise choices. That's what the Triple Gem represents to me. Others have made wise choices, then I could make wise choices too. This is possible. Recollecting one's virtues. We've talked about virtue a little bit already, recollecting one's generosity. Then recollecting the devas are all cause for joy to arise. So this is maybe something not often talked about so much in the West, because it seems kind of strange to us, the Buddhist cosmology, all these devas. Well, there's not really supposed to be a creator god, but how come there's all these devas and realms? But I'd like to read something. Now, in the West, in the East, it seems like in their cultures, there isn't a problem with kind of thinking about different realms and different and devas. So I find that interesting that, you know, it might be a, you know, kind of part of our cultural conditioning. So this is what Ajahn Jeff has written about recollecting the devas, cause for happiness to arise. Recollection of the devas is a meditation exercise few people practice, but it's a useful practice for several reasons. It reminds us of the possibilities out there. People sometimes have visions when they meditate, and beings sometimes appear in the visions. If you have an impoverished cosmology like we have in the West, we may not know how to be with this experience that we, you know, comes up in our meditation. We might be frightened, or we may think we are somehow special and might inflate our ego having this special vision. The recommendation is to just treat these visions politely as neighbors you want to get along with. So, visions like this might happen in your meditation. It doesn't happen only in Asia. I know people who, especially here in the southwest of America, have had lots of visions when they go to places like Bryce, Zion, or the Arches, like these magnificent kind of areas in the southwest. So spirits, they would have visions of spirits of natives. They might have visions of the coyote god, lots of spirits corresponding with Native American legends. And some of these meditators have no knowledge of Native American legends. So it's good to remember the basic principle for how you treat devas. You recollect their virtues. You treat them with respect. And then you take what you learn from them and you put it to the test to see if it really is conducive to training the mind. And what are the deva virtues that we can recollect? Faith, virtue, discernment, and goodwill. So it's possible that in one's meditation, a vision will arise. So I think this is good advice. You treat the, you know, you don't make that into, oh, I'm special because I've had a vision. And you treat this vision with respect, as he says, you treat them politely as neighbors you want to get along with. And they might tell you something that's useful and skillful, or maybe not. But we can put it to the test. We can see for ourselves, is this skillful? So Christina Feldman has written, confidence in the path we are walking, which to me says like confidence in the Dhamma, confidence in the path we are walking brings joy. Aspiration brings joy. And to know that every moment of care and compassion truly matters, that also brings joy. By the way, I was just kind of remembering something that had come to mind with that. I'm going to go back now to the beginning of this talk where I was talking about dust in the eyes. And so there's a you know, where the Buddha wasn't quite sure, like nobody would get it. And then he's convinced, okay, some people with little dust in the eyes, we're talking about, well, what does the dust mean? You know, different obstacles to our path. And then the Buddha, after he makes this decision to teach, he travels to, he decides to teach what's called the Group of Five, the five ascetics that he had practiced with before his enlightenment. So he goes there to Sarnath, which is close to Varanasi by the Ganges River. So he walks there and approaches the five ascetics and ends up giving them his very first teaching, which is on the Four Noble Truths. He outlines Four Noble Truths about suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and then the fourth truth is the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is kind of the foundational teaching of the Buddha. So while he's giving this teaching to these five ascetics, he noticed one of the ascetics, whose name is Kandanya, something has shifted in Kandanya. He noticed something is different. And then the Buddha makes the statement of, Kandanya has the dustless, stainless Dhamma eye. So what that means is Kandanya has entered the first stage of enlightenment. Kandanya is a quick study, right? He just got this teaching and first stage of enlightenment. But that phrase kind of struck me because, again, that metaphor was being used about dust in the eye. And so it seemed like maybe the path is, you know, lots of dust in the eye, less dust in the eye, little dust in the eye, no dust in the eye. But this kind of metaphor was used kind of three times then in the suttas. So that's our goal. No dust in the eyes. Not gone. So maybe I'll just read this the story to conclude the talk, and kind of a nice story. Again, it's kind of like the chess story. Is sometimes our teachers, it's surprising like where teachings come from. And so this is a story from a father of a young boy. My evening routine usually consists of putting my three-year-old son to bed after dinner, of which the routine consists of reading a book and playing some calming music for him beside his crib. About 2 weeks ago, I had to work late, and by the time I got home, I was feeling exhausted, a little bit grumpy and frazzled. The thought occurred to me that I should sit, I should meditate, but I was in this routine mode. So after reading my son his book and laying him in his crib, I moved to turn the music on. He stopped me and he said, "Daddy, you meditate." Taking orders from his three-year-old. "Daddy, meditate." I was shocked as he repeated himself. I said that I would go downstairs and sit, to which he responded, "No, no, Daddy, you sit here." So I grabbed my cushion and started meditating on metta, like right in the child's room. After 20 minutes, I opened my eyes and my son had been staring at me the entire time. He asked me if I felt better, to which I responded, "Yes." He said, "Good. You can go now." His bedtime routine now consists of me meditating and sometimes him reciting metta phrases with me beside his crib while he falls asleep. I continue to be amazed by the fruits of Dhamma practice and surprised to discover where my Dhamma teachers manifest in my life. So, be open to receiving lessons from, you know, we don't know who. It's could be surprising. So those are some thoughts on joy. I think what I'd like to do now is just take 25 minutes for some walking or just kind of chilling a bit, and then we'll reassemble at 3:30 just for some kind of closing thoughts on this this theme. Let me see here. Okay, so here's one definition of happiness from Charles Dickens. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditures, £19.06. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditures, £20.06. Result, misery. So maybe something to that. And one more from a monk, Ajahn Jayasaro. I have always liked stories, and particularly stories that require the main character to suffer a little bit, shed a few tears on the way, before being resolved with a happy ending. Now, the Noble Eightfold Path is my favorite story, and enlightenment is the ultimate happy ending. That's from a little book from Ajahn Jayasaro. I'm sure it's available online, but it's On Love is the book. So I just thought, I was just walking outside and I thought, maybe stretch the boundaries of what we do here. I was reminded we're in 2019, I was fortunate enough to go on a trip to Asia. It was my first time to Asia, and a small group went to India to visit the Buddhist holy sites. And there's four main holy sites. They kind of follow the life of the Buddha, the Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, Bodh Gaya, where the enlightenment took place, and then Sarnath, he gave his first teaching, and then Kusinara, where he died. So it kind of follows the Buddha's Buddha's life. And we were fortunate enough to be accompanied by two Thai forest monks as we were traveling to these different sites. And we would go to the sites and spend a few days, and we would meditate there. Maybe the senior monk might give a little teaching, appropriate to the site, or just we would kind of look around the site and just kind of feel what it was like there. But what they always did at these different sites that we would visit was do a particular chant that would start. We would have a little meditation session, and they would do this chant. So it's the invitations to the devas. And one of these monks was talking that he thought there were, at these, very special sites, there was a whole lot of devas around, and we better kind of just let them know we're friendly folks. So it's a particularly beautiful chant. So it's called Invitation to the Devas. And I think we're going to be able to play it. Suzanne's going to play it. And we can hear it as well as the Zoom folks. Doesn't matter. Okay, so our speaker's on? Yeah, okay.
Invitation to the Devas.
Maybe just bring the volume up.
Paritava namitang
So I think that's a good place to end.